This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we will visit with Judith Sylvester, LSU mass communication professor, who for 14 years has led a charge to ban smoking on the LSU campus, and her quest is complete. What will the reaction be come fall at LSU? We'll discuss it with Dr. Judith Sylvester. Also, Amin Walker, a business consultant with First Financial of Baton Rouge. He's filed more than 500 business economic loss claims in the BP settlement, and it's involving the Deepwater Horizon program that is under review in the courts. Last week, BP lost its battle in the Fifth Circuit, and now the oil giant from Great Britain says it'll take its business to the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll talk about it. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers are 877-217-5757, wherever you may be. 297-5633 if you're dialing in Baton Rouge, and you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Frank Barnett is producing, and today is a sad day for Louisiana. The Dean of Louisiana Political Commentators and columnist John McGinnis died early yesterday in New Orleans. He was 66 years old. He covered the Capitol like nobody else for 40 years and wrote two of the most compelling books ever about Louisiana politics, The Last Hayride, 1983, about the race between Edwin Edwards and David Treen, and Cross to Bear, the 1991 battle royal between Edwards, David Duke, and Buddy Romer. And those books will be read long after all of us are gone, and John McGinnis leaves an indelible mark on journalism and politics in Louisiana. We will miss him. He was a frequent guest on this program, and we will be talking about John for as long as we live. We wish the best to his widow, Jackie, and to his many friends and family, and we know that his work will continue with Jeremy Alford leading La Politics. And John McGinnis, not so long ago on this show, was quite proud of how that began. After Grigri went away, he began with Facts Weekly, and then it evolved into LaPolitics.com. And he noted that Jack Harris was his first subscriber. Services are still pending for John McGinnis, and I'm sure we'll have occasion to talk about him in the days, weeks, months, and years to come. We're joined in studio by LSU mass communications professor Judith Sylvester. She, for 14 years of her 20 years on campus, has led a charge to have a tobacco-free campus, and that's what LSU is starting this fall. Good morning, Dr. Sylvester.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
You've been here before, and in previous visits, you talked about how you were trying to do this. Well, it finally got through all the hoops, and you have what you want. How did you do it?
Well, first of all, I am here speaking on behalf of Fresh Campus, which is our student organization, and my own tobacco education program, Smoking Words. And we are a grantee of the Louisiana Campaign for Tobacco-Free Living. I'm telling you this because it's not just me who's done this by any means. It has taken a village to get us where we are today, and it certainly has involved several people on the LSU campus who have supported this and helped move it along, and just generally, and a lot of students too, who really see the advantages to us being a tobacco-free campus. So that's how it all starts. Also, I want to put it in some context because a lot's being made about LSU doing this, but the reality is we're behind the curve in a lot of ways. Several other college campuses in the state already have had policies in place for 1 to 2 years. And in addition to that, I just checked last week, and of all of the SEC schools, the only two that don't have published tobacco policies of some sort is Alabama and LSU. So we're maybe on track to beat Alabama.
Happened the last three times they played in football, but LSU is ahead of Alabama as far as a tobacco-free campus. And that brings us to our first question. If you'd like to join the conversation, 297-5633. Lou asked if tobacco-free means no smokeless tobacco. Is that included?
Yes. There is a distinction between being smoke-free and being tobacco-free. And some of the SEC campuses are only smoke-free. If you're smoke-free, it's basically talking about all the combustibles, which includes e-cigarettes. If you're talking about tobacco-free, then we're also including in the policy all of the chewing tobacco, snuff, any dissolvables, which the tobacco companies have turned to in order to try to keep their markets going and target a lot of these products toward college students. I would like to say, though, in terms of e-cigarettes, we really didn't have much of a choice about including that regardless of which way the policy goes, because they're not an FDA-approved device, and so they have their own set of issues. So that would be included in any tobacco policy.
So somebody couldn't use an e-cigarette in a classroom, a professor, or a student?
No, and actually, we've had an indoor policy for a long time, so there really shouldn't be any use of it in the classrooms, in the buildings at all.
That's different, isn't it?
What do you mean?
The e-cigarette. Some people don't think that's the same.
I know a lot of people don't, but there are huge issues with e-cigarettes, and I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this, but I think that it is important to note that the FDA is trying to regulate them. Right now they are totally unregulated, which means that we don't know for sure what's in them. And the fact that they have cartridges in them that are pure nicotine. And what most people don't understand is that if you get that nicotine directly on your hands or whatever as you're handling it, it's absorbed through the skin. It's not something that can be just washed off. So what we're seeing with e-cigarettes across the country is a huge rise in poison control issues, especially with toddlers who can easily ingest them. And then also animals. Dogs can lick them up, too, and it'll kill them.
297-5633 for Judith Sylvester, LSU Mass Communication Professor for 20 years, an associate professor who has led the charge to ban smoking on campus for the last 14 years. In the Advocate front page, May 18th, in a story by Elizabeth Crisp, Judith says, "I'm very, very happy, but I'm also very realistic. A lot of varies. Just having the policy is less than half the battle. So what's the other?"
Well, the other half is getting acceptance and support for it. And I want to make it really clear that the aim of this is to change the campus culture, not to be handing out tickets and being punitive with it, because we understand that it is an addiction. In addition to the fact that it's a habit. So you have to change the patterns. You have to do that. We will be offering some smoking cessation support on campus this fall. And there's also already several entities in the state that are involved with the cessation support. So we have to, though, get the whole community involved in this. Everybody's going to have a responsibility to make sure that everybody on campus is aware of the policy. This is going to apply to visitors. So visitors, we have a big information campaign to promote here. And then it's really going to be self-enforcing to a great extent, just as our indoor air policy is now, and very successfully so. And then it's just, as I said, going to take the whole campus being willing to step up and say to anybody they see smoking on campus, "You probably aren't aware of our policy. Here's our policy. Please take your cigarette off campus."
So what happens if, let's say, a student is defiantly lighting up on the steps of the journalism school in the middle of the day? What happens to that individual?
Well, like I said, the goal is to, first of all, have a peer come up and say, "You know, this isn't acceptable. We're a smoke-free, tobacco-free campus now, and so you need to not smoke here." That'll be in place for quite a while. I don't see us really immediately jumping into anything more serious. We've got to give that some time to work.
But if the person is resistant and says,
there are remedies in place, just as there are with any other policy on campus.
But tickets will not be written.
No, we're not involving the police in this at all. And so, that's not our goal here. Our goal is not to make it a punishment. Our goal is to make it an educational endeavor.
Well, it sounds like a rule with no teeth.
Well, that's not entirely true, as I said. But we at least want to give it a year with warnings and talking and all of that. There will be, I think, and keep in mind that the policy, I still haven't know for sure. I've seen the final version of this policy because it still is awaiting the president's signature, as I understand it. But in that policy, there would be some ways, some mechanisms, just as for students, just as there are for violations of alcohol or illegal drugs or anything like that. For faculty and staff, it would probably go through their dean or through our HRM, human resource management deal.
Okay. 297-5633. And another question from a listener, and this is one that I think will come up more than once in the next few months. What happens for tailgaters who are accustomed to smoking before LSU games? According to the policy, they will be in violation, right?
They can stay in their vehicles. We're perfectly happy to let them do that.
So you can smoke in your vehicle if you have the windows rolled up?
If you have the windows rolled up. And some universities actually don't even allow that. So we're trying to be a little bit
flexible.
Well,
some of that could, get outside the vehicle and you could be a victim of secondhand smoke,
well,
Dr. Sylvester.
Hopefully I can stay out of the parking lots. But no, I mean, I want to make it clear again that there's not going to be any police roaming around and saying, hey, you've got to take care of this. But I do see it. I see it as an SEC issue. Because our fans are not going to be able to smoke when they go visit other campuses, and they're not expecting to be inundated with secondhand smoke when they come here. So if the goal is to make to fill our seats and to make the LSU experience the best experience possible, this is going to go a long way to improving that.
Well, I think there will be less smoking for sure, but there also will be more fisticuffs. I saw this once at the old Varsity Theater when films were being shown there. Somebody lit up a cigarette in the middle of a movie, The Last Temptation of Christ, and a fight broke out right in the theater, and cops were called. It was quite a scene.
Well, I'm not anticipating anything like that.
Barbara Hershey was on the big screen as Mary Magdalene, and she was overshadowed by the action in the movie theater.
Keep in mind that we have not allowed smoking in the stadium for quite a while. So it's just taking it
stadium,
a little bit further out.
But if you were out there before the game,
there's a lot
of that going on.
It's bad.
297-5633 is your number. Charlotte in Iberia Parish. Charlotte, you're on the air with Dr. Judith Sylvester.
Good morning to both of you. Thank you for taking my call. I am calling because in Texas there was a college that instituted the no smoking on campus, and they advised people if you wanted to, you could sit in your vehicle and keep your windows rolled up. However, I think they later changed that because carbon monoxide is also one of those byproducts of smoking. So they let them roll the windows down. I don't believe people want people dying because they can't control their habits.
So are you okay with the windows being rolled down, Dr. Sylvester?
Well, the policy doesn't speak to this directly, so I think that's something that we will see what happens. The goal is to really encourage people not to smoke. And we really have a responsibility to our students to reinforce that idea that they're much better off being tobacco free. And in fact, on the national level, there are several movements afoot coming from the Surgeon General's office and the CDC to create a tobacco-free generation. And we're the last line of defense in that, because if we can keep people from smoking before the age of 26, 90% of them will never smoke.
Judith Sylvester, declaring victory as LSU is now a smoke-free and tobacco-free campus starting this fall. What will happen as a result of this? We'll talk a bit more with Dr. Sylvester when we return after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. And Dr. Judith Sylvester, LSU Mass Communication Associate Professor, is with us for a little while longer to talk about her mission, which has been successful, to ban smoking and tobacco products on the LSU main campus. The Old War School is now a tobacco-free zone this fall. There is no policy in place to arrest people or give them tickets. It's basically a scout's honor kind of thing. But as I stated before, there bound to be some fights, probably before LSU football games when people are drinking as they're tailgating, and some people like to smoke when they drink, and when they're told not to, some of them will become belligerent. After all, it is the prelude to battle on the football field. 297-5633 if you'd like to chime in. Charlotte and Iberia Parish had a point as we hit the break, saying that the policy which requires people to roll up their windows in their cars could result in carbon monoxide poisoning for some poor smoker. Or do you have pity on these people, Judith Sylvester?
Well, like I said, we're not really addressing that right now. And I think that what we want to do, as I said before, is to let people know that that is their option. Our main goal is just to get, we're not telling anybody they have to quit. We're hoping that they will, but we're not telling them they have to. So certainly in their personal cars, in their homes, things like that, even off campus, we're not trying to regulate anything. But the whole society is moving in that direction. We've already had, since 2007, the Smoke-Free Air Act that's taken it out of restaurants and public buildings, and the state legislature has just even recently moved to prohibit the sale of e-cigarettes to children below the age of 18. So the whole society is still moving in that direction. And nationally, there are 12,000 college campuses, 1,200 college campuses that have smoke-free or tobacco-free policies in place. 800 of those are tobacco-free. So we're just part of a trend that's going on in our society. And I might add, this is the 50th anniversary of the first Surgeon General's report on the danger of tobacco. So for 50 years, we've known this is bad stuff. And we've become a lot more aware of the dangers of secondhand smoke and the vapors that come from, you know, vaping is a big trend among students right now. And that's not safe either.
Well, there are a lot of professors who smoke. And I would say, as far as a percentage, there are probably more professors on a percentage basis who smoke than students.
No. The student rate's close to 30%. It's never been above 12% for faculty. It's a little bit higher for staff. But no, the faculty, by and large,
are
with it.
Why do you think that's the case?
Well, I'm sorry?
Why do you think that's the case?
Well, I think for the reason that it's so high for students is because a lot of that 30% are social smokers. So they tend to smoke and reinforce each other in social situations. A lot of students use it for ice breaking, way to meet somebody, offer them a cigarette. Women tend to use it because for weight control issues and just because it's very hard. It's harder for women to quit. And I think the bottom underlying...
Why is it harder for women to quit?
It has to do a lot with their metabolism and with their... the way they use tobacco, which is, as I said, a lot of times it's for weight support. But the underlying thing all across the board is stress. And so I'm hoping that we also deal very much with the stress issues that will help people who want to quit, and help those who might use tobacco as a way to cope with stress to find that there are alternatives, such as exercise.
Christy asks if this includes dorms and sorority and fraternity houses.
It does. And the sorority and fraternity houses abide by, they have contracts that say they will abide by university policies. And again, though, it's going to be self-enforcing in those areas, and so I think it's important to know that. With the residence halls, we have a pretty bad problem with students standing right outside the doors and smoking, and there's not been a lot of good remedy for that. And now we have a remedy. Now we can start with the freshmen and build on this. It's not going to be perfect on day one. I don't expect it to be, but I think it's going to be accepted a lot more than you think. I don't think there's going to be fights.
I think there will be some fights. It's just a question
no,
of how many
because,
fights.
Because we're not going to be confrontational about it.
Maybe you won't, but I just know how this goes. And people, when they feel like they have a right that's being taken away from them, and whether that's true or not, they may feel that way. Mm-hmm. And somebody questions them, and they've been drinking. It's a prescription for hostilities.
Well, I don't think it's been a problem on any other campus that's done this.
Gustavo and Tara, good morning. You're on with
hey.
Dr. Sylvester.
Great topic, great decision. I'm not a smoker, haven't been in 40 years, but I do think that there is a little bit of concern about the smoker rights, but never mind that. I just had a question. What about the tailgaters for football games or baseball games or what have you?
I think we've been talking mm-hmm. about that, if you've been listening, Gustavo, but it's an issue. Why not have a tailgating exception?
Well, once you start with exceptions, then everybody wants an exception.
Okay. 297-5633, HB in Denham Springs. Hello, HB. You're on with Judith Sylvester.
Good morning. Doctor, I think it, if memory serves me correctly, LSU was even toying around with the idea of their own brewery and their own brand of beer, LSU beer. Why not do the same thing with alcohol? Because if a person gets intoxicated at the game, before the game, and then after the game kills someone, that's a lot more serious than someone's on a cigarette. Your opinion, please, ma'am. Thank you.
Well, that is, I will just say, it's not something that I have focused on a whole lot. And yes, there have been movements to do that. But we do have alcohol policies in place that do govern student behavior. But that's you know, it's not just an LSU problem. That is something that exists in the society in general. And I think that it really comes about with parents and, you know, everybody on campus again getting involved with this. And what I'm hoping we will see is that if we really push the idea of respect for the campus, and by the way, the students have floated around or actually have put in place a kind of an honor code for LSU for the fall. And I think that the whole movement is to have much more respect for the campus, to care about the environmental issues. We haven't even talked about the environmental issues involved with this, which are much greater for tobacco than they are for anything else. And we have tons of cigarette butts. It costs LSU at least $36,000 a year just in daily maintenance around our buildings. That doesn't even include the events.
All right. Well, we will hopefully reconvene with Dr. Sylvester in the fall when this goes into effect, and she is optimistic that it will be a lot of roses, kind of like Dick Cheney's prediction when the U.S. invaded Iraq. We'll see if there will
I absolutely
be a
refuse
pushback
to
on
believe
this.
It's going to be that kind of a situation.
Okay. Thank you, though. I think you're commended for your diligence in seeing this to the finish line. 297-5633 is your number, and we're joined in studio by Amin Walker, a business consultant who is president of First Financial of Baton Rouge. His firm has filed more than 500 business economic loss claims regarding the Deepwater Horizon settlement program. And last week, British oil giant BP defiantly announced that it will ask the U.S. Supreme Court to require that businesses prove the Gulf of Mexico oil spill caused them financial losses before they can collect money from a multi-billion dollar settlement of private claims resulting from the Deepwater Horizon disaster of 4 years ago. This came after the Fifth Circuit voted 8-5 against BP. And good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning.
Well, I think I know where you're going to stand on this, and I must, as a disclaimer, and I say that Amin was on this show a few years back when this process just began, and I was impressed enough that our company, the Louisiana Radio Network, filed a claim that was handled by Mr. Walker. So we have that out of the way, and now we have many companies who are waiting to see what happens. What's the next step?
They are, Jim. And, you know, just a little recap. You know, when this thing first started, BP said to everybody in, on all the commercials, we want to make it right. We want to, you know, we know that we made mistakes and we're going to get everybody straight. And so, you know, they spent about 2 years negotiating with the plaintiff's attorney group to come up with a settlement. And it resulted in about an 1,100-page settlement that wasn't real fun to read, but it was very specific. And in that settlement, both sides gave up something. But, you know, starting in about August of last year, BP started challenging some of the payments that were being made. And unfortunately, they can say what they want, but what it seems is that BP approximated about $7.8 billion worth of payouts, and they had to adjust that number to about $9.2 billion. And so the reality started setting in, so they started thinking about what can we do to slow this thing down.
Now, Edith Brown Clement, the Fifth Circuit judge who has been the biggest dissenter on this issue, she was one of the five to vote no, and previously one of the three. It was a 2-1 decision, and she was the one to vote no in the 3-person panel on the BP claims. She says the class of people who will recover from this settlement continues to include significant numbers of people whose losses, if any, were not caused by BP. Does she have a point?
She does not have a point to say a significant number. Now, granted, when they were negotiating this, and there was, let's understand, once this preliminary order was signed in March that both sides had agreed to, there was an additional hearing 6 months later in November, which was called a fairness hearing, where both sides were to get together in front of the judge and say, we've seen 6 months of this, this is what's happening, this is what we're happy with, and this is what we're not happy with. And specifically, in an email that the Judge Barbier, who is the federal judge overseeing it initially, sent to BP explaining that there were going to be situations, for instance, when a partner, a 3-person firm, lost a partner and they had a decrease in income, would they be included? And BP specifically stated in the email back to the court that they understood that there were going to be some claimants that actually did not qualify and were not directly affected from this bill. But conversely, it's important to note that there were a lot of claimants who were affected by this bill that could not file a claim because they did not meet this revenue pattern that was put out there. And specifically, I'm talking about the businesses that had to close. They lost so much business that they closed, and they're in what's called Zone D, which is the northernmost zone. Those businesses could not file claims.
Basically, what businesses are attempting to show is that in 2010, after the BP disaster, that their revenues went down. And perhaps they were up in 9, down in 10, and up in 11. And it would seem that there might be a case that the Deepwater Horizon disaster had an impact on that. And there are two questions here, I think, that warrant attention. And one is, are there people and companies getting benefits as a result of this who are just taking advantage of the system, as Judge Clement claims, and others do as well? And did BP agree to this, and can they back off on an agreement that they essentially signed off on? So the first one, I think the answer is yes. There probably are companies.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And with any class action suit, there are going to be some people that slide in that weren't intended to be in that suit.
But the second one, you're saying, and some legal analysts, many, say BP signed off on this, they endorsed it, and now they're going back on a deal. In fact, the Associated Press account of the latest move by BP to go to the U.S. Supreme Court reads, the last year BP asked the Fifth Circuit to throw out the deal it once had lauded, arguing in court filings that the settlement can be salvaged if properly construed and implemented. How could it be tweaked at this point?
Well, and you know what? They did make one adjustment, and I can understand that adjustment that they made in the fall of last year, which was the lower court did approve a matching revenue and expense issue. And you know, in the document, it was a little unclear because it says that you will take the revenue and its corresponding expenses. Well, the claim center just took that as 1 month in 1 year compared to another month in another year. So there was a little tweaking there, and that was okay. You know, what BP is asking for now is not a tweaking. They're asking for either the people to forget that they said it was okay to use this V-shaped revenue curve, and that if you met it, we'd assume that you met the causation requirements. What they're looking for is a restructuring of the entire settlement, and that's not going to happen. And, you know, the interesting thing, and I'll probably go too far in this, but, you know, I'm going to go against all of the economic, all of the legal arguments that people are making why BP is doing this. And I'm going to say it's very simple. They're doing it to try to delay who's filing a claim. They're trying to put smaller companies out of business from doing claims. And it's just a legal tactic that they're using to draw this thing out so people will drop out.
Now, you speak, Amin Walker, as a business consultant who has a stake in this, obviously, and the outcome of this litigation. Now, the British oil giant claims that the people are taking advantage of BP. BP's profits indicate that it is doing well in spite of this, but it has delayed the process. There's no doubt about that. Jordan wants to know if people can still file a claim. Is that still possible at this point?
Absolutely, they can. The initial deadline was April 22nd of this year, but because BP continues to appeal the way the suit is written, it will be 6 months after the final appeal is ruled upon. And this is something that BP knows, and you might say, why would they keep going to make people file? But it's definitely been more beneficial for them, and I'm going to say it very simply. There have been, according to the last report by the Claim Center, 52,741 people who have withdrawn their claim or not responded to notices for additional information. And at $66,000 a case as an average settlement, that's $3.5 billion BP just saved by forcing these people out.
Mm-hmm. 297-5633. And many media outlets have filed claims, but many in the media have also benefited from an advertising blitz by BP.
Absolutely.
Taking advertising money from the British oil giant in which BP claims that this is nonsense, that it's unfair, and that there are people and companies and areas that are in several hundred miles from the coast who are benefiting from this. There is a formula, though, isn't there, where if you're closer to the action where the BP disaster occurred, you benefit more. Isn't that a reality?
It is. You do benefit more, and you know, your second question had asked, you know, are there some tweakings that can be done and things that BP agreed upon? And what BP is going against now is there have been four zones set up for this, and Zone A is considered the one closest to the coast. That's going to be within 10 miles of the Gulf. And those businesses, all businesses in Zone A, are exempted from proving any liabilities to this. Now, this is what BP is upset about, is they don't have to prove their point, but they agreed upon.
Where is Baton Rouge?
Baton Rouge is in Zone D.
Zone D.
D as in Delta.
Okay. The last zone.
Correct.
297-5633 is your number, and we shall return with business consultant Amin Walker discussing BP going to the U.S. Supreme Court. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. And you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We resume the conversation with Amin Walker, a First Financial of Baton Rouge. His firm has filed more than 500 claims in the Deepwater Horizon Settlement Program, which BP originally signed off on, but now has gone to court in a big way to try to overturn its own signing. Now, Amin Walker, of course, has a horse in this field, so it's not unexpected that he would be saying that BP is out of line, but he's joined by many others, including eight members of the Fifth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeal, which last week voted 8-5 against BP's claim. But the British oil giant says, next step, U.S. Supreme Court. What are the odds of getting the Supreme Court to hear a case like this? You're not a lawyer, neither am I, but some experts say that the court, which receives about 10,000 petitions a year, is unlikely to make this one of the 80 cases it would hear. We'll see.
And, you know, Jim, you're right. I'm not an attorney either. But, you know, you read these things, you look at these things and see and weigh them out. And it's very unlikely that the Supreme Court will hear this case. Obviously, it doesn't have anything to do with constitutional law. It is strictly a civil case. And I think on the surface, when you look at it and say two sides got together, negotiated for 2 years and came up with a settlement, both agreed upon it. Both had 6 months to work it and try it out and see how it was going, and both still agreed upon it. Why should we get rid of it now, or why should we even rehear this case? You know, but Judge, as you mentioned, Judge Brown, Edith Brown Clement down in New Orleans has, from what I read, one of the interesting things is Supreme Court will often hear cases where the lower courts were in disagreement. And so she's almost laid out an argument for it to be heard with the Supreme Court. But again, chances of it being one of the 80 cases that are heard are very, very slim.
We don't know that, though. We don't know that they won't hear it.
Correct.
And with a majority of conservative, business-inclined justices on the court, if it went to the high court, BP might very well get a majority of the U.S. Supreme Court. But there are two issues, and one is the business issue, which BP claims that some unworthy recipients of benevolence from the British oil giant are getting big checks as a result of this. And then there's the other one, did BP back away from a settlement that it endorsed? And so there are two issues that would obviously be front and center before the U.S. Supreme Court. You've handled 500 claims, and by the way, I must say, we have invited people from BP on this program, but to this point without success. But if somebody representing British Petroleum is listening to this program, we would certainly invite a representative from BP to give BP's side of the case. But you've had 500 cases. That's got to be one of the largest numbers in Zone D. Are most of them in this area?
Most are in Zone D, but we do have representatives from each zone. And yes, it is the largest number in Louisiana by any one firm. And I want to say
largest number in Louisiana, which correct. Was a state affected probably more than any other state by this. So you're probably one of the largest in
correct.
The country.
Correct. And you know, I want to point out something. We actually received business claims from close to 1,400 different businesses. Only 500 of those met the pre-qualifications that BP and the claimant's attorneys agreed upon. And we filed those 500 claims. Now, since everything has been happening in the court, we specifically went back and tried to take a look at who actually slid in based on, you know, the existing ways that they set forth. And we actually had 3 out of 500 that probably should not have qualified for a claim but did because of the way the calculations are set. Whereas we were also looking at 900 people who didn't qualify. And many of those, as I said, about 95 of those were businesses that had gone out of business but are in Zone D, so they don't qualify anymore. And, you know, I'll give you one specific one. We have somebody that is a catering company, 2 offshore oil rigs, and they had to close, but they're in Zone D, so they don't qualify because they did not have the upturn in 2011.
So if you got shut down because 2010 was a bad year, and your claim is that it was a bad year because of the Deepwater Horizon incident, and you don't have an 11 year to match 10, you're out of luck.
Correct. And if you actually a better 11 years. So some of them didn't qualify because it took them 2 or 3 years to recover. And you know, I want to say this too, and I haven't heard this argument. Nobody seems to be talking about it, but it's very simple. You cannot directly tie this bill to any business unless they are, say, a business that does their business offshore. you look at a car dealership and say, how would that be related? Well, you know, there's a very big company here in town that has workers at work offshore, and they suffered a loss when things when the spill happened. And those workers who were working 70, 80 hours a week now got cut back to 35 and 40 hours a week after the spill. Well, those are the same people that didn't go out to eat as much. They didn't go to the car dealership and buy a car. They didn't go to that construction company and ask them to remodel their kitchen because their income dropped so much.
All right. 297-5633 is your number for Amin Walker. Of the 500, a listener, Billy, wants to know how many of those claims have been signed off on. Some of them got through before the court process picked up in full bloom.
Correct. We have about 17% of those. So, you know, around a little under 9,000 of those claims got settled.
No.
I'm sorry, a little under 90, you know, 80. I think it was 87 or 88 to be precise.
So of the 500. So
correct.
You still have, now did any get rejected?
Two did get rejected, but we were aware of both of those going into it. That one, they had both signed a form earlier saying that they would accept a small amount of money as total settlement. But since things had changed, they had the opportunity to reapply and see if they could have qualified for more.
Okay, so I think I got the math right here. 500 claims, you say 87 were endorsed, two were rejected, so that would leave about 411 that are still pending.
And that is, and there are that many. And I will tell you, you know, of those ones that did get paid, actually nine of those, there is a built-in appeal process within the claims procedures where they look at those claims, and BP has a chance to say, we disagree with this one because of this reason. And we had nine of those, but we won all nine of those appeals because we're just following the rules
and
that were set out.
And who determined the result of the appeals?
There is an independent group of attorneys that has been hired by the court, and it's an appeals panel. And so those people, the appeals are spread between those to look at it to see if the law had been followed.
Well, Amin Walker is with First Financial, and 500 claims have been filed by his company with the Deepwater Horizon Settlement Program. And he says this is the largest number of any firm in Louisiana. So with 411 still pending, I would imagine your firm is pretty close in percentage with the settlement as a whole. So most of the claims are still out there, still
absolutely
floating.
Most of the claims are out there because you have to realize since September, the end of September of last year, they've processed some claims, which the claim center says it has about $1 billion worth of settlements ready to release but cannot release because of this court hold. But again, there's still probably 60-70% of the claims have not even been heard yet.
Well, we shall follow this, and we may have occasion to talk with you again, Mr.
Call Walker. Your state representatives.
Well, at this point, the U.S. Supreme Court will be the ultimate authority, and at the very least, it would seem it would take months before the Supreme Court says yes or no.
It would, and you know, one of the interesting things is there is a part of the original settlement, and nobody's talked about this, but there's one paragraph in this 1,100 pages that says, if the settlement for any reason terminates and becomes null and void, the claims administrator will continue to process claims that have been submitted. So in other words, they have to go ahead and finish those claims that are sitting there waiting.
Well,
even if the Supreme Court turns
I would
down.
Imagine BP would challenge that as well. That would be my guess.
I don't think BP expects to win or even be heard by the Supreme Court. I think that, like I said, they've done a very good job enforcing small preparing agencies out of business or out of the claims business. They've, you know, deterred a lot of people from filing.
Well, we shall follow it. Thank you, Amin Walker.
Thank you.
We're joined in studio now by James Dean Clater, a familiar name to this program because we've had his brother, the senator, and former linebacker Dan Clater on many times. And James Dean Clater is in another line of work. What do you do, James?
I'm a writer, and I work mainly in film and music.
All right. I don't think your microphone's working, so let's move in another direction here. You're a writer, a screenwriter, and a songwriter, right?
Songwriter, composer, yeah.
So you have taken a different path in life than your brother. Who runs the bookstore?
Well, that's my brother Rob and my brother John.
So there are four Clater brothers.
There's four.
There's the Clater Quartet.
That's right.
And you're the artistic one of the bunch.
Somewhat, I'd say, yeah.
Yeah. Your name's James Dean Clater. Were you named after the actor?
No, I wasn't. That's from my mom's side. I was going to be James Daniel III, but then my mom says, well, what about my side of the family?
Yeah.
So James Dean.
Well, certainly a good name. James Dean Clater. And you have done a little more than write. You're now in the performing realm.
Yeah. What happened was I was in a band back in high school with Randy Jackson, Herman Jackson, and John Gerbrek, a bunch of guys from Lehigh, and the band was called Tempest. And so Randy went to go play for Dr. John. I filled in for him. I became the bass player, and that was when I was 16. And from there on,
for Dr. John.
Yeah. Well, John, Dr. John took Randy, right? And then I was a replacement in Tempest. So that's when I started.
Okay. Well, Frank Barnett has a sampling of James Dean Clater, who's a talented member of a well-known family in this area. Let's give a listen.
Well, what you're hearing there is Michel Martineau. He's a clarinetist from Canada, from Gastineau. I met him through SoundCloud, and it turns out he's one of the top clarinetists in the world. So I've got him on the album. This is the newest album, Pseudonyms, and that song is Gustavo, which is oblique reference to, you know, Hurricane Gus. And the next song after that, Buongiorno Baby, has Dave Panico from Kansas City. And what happened was I did the masters and then sent them through the internet to each of those players, and then they did their sessions in their respective studios.
Well, for those who wish to secure a copy of Pseudonyms, what should they do?
Well, you can, of course, get it on iTunes or Spotify or Shazam or any of the online systems. But in Baton Rouge, there's only one place right now, and that is Highland Coffees on the North Gates.
Highland Coffees.
That's right.
Clark Cadzo.
Clark's the man. I know you're listening,
Clark.
Passing out
copies of Pseudonyms. Okay. Well, we know where Highland Coffees is. And when you and your brother Dan get together, do you talk more about music or politics?
Usually he's asking me, can he play bass on one of the songs?
Is he a good musician, too?
Dan can play bass, yeah.
Really?
Oh,
really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, he's trying to go to Capitol Hill. There are a lot of good jazz places in Washington, D.C. So win or lose, he might have a future on Capitol Hill.
I know he could stand in with most of the guys there.
Well, I'm reading a story from C.B. for Gonston. C.B. writes, in what can be best described as the Senate Finance Committee losing its collective mind, all but one of the members voted on Sunday, yesterday, to take money from the developmentally disabled statewide to fund a private auto racetrack in Jefferson Parish. Senator Dan Clater said it all. We're taking money away from the disabled company and giving it to motorsports. And then CB says, Jack Donahue, the committee chair, said, the answer to your question, Senator Clater, is yes. So Dan's got his hands full right now.
Well, you know, Dan seems to be he knows what he's doing. I don't really follow politics that much, but I know he's been on the show a few times, and I have listened, so I'm learning a few things.
I see yard signs out. He's running for Congress in the same race with Edwin Edwards and Garrett Graves and Paul Dietzel. And Dan's giving his best shot, but this is heavy lifting trying to be elected to the U.S. House of Representatives.
I predict he wins.
Well, you predict he wins. Who will we be in a runoff with? There's going to be a runoff in that race. There's no question. There will be a December runoff. So who's in the runoff with him?
Well, it'd have to be Edwards, wouldn't it?
Edwin Edwards and Dan Clater?
I think so.
The linebacker and the four-term former governor. That would be an interesting runoff scenario. So, and two well-known names, but as well-known as the Clater name is in Baton Rouge, I don't think it's as well-known as the Edwards name.
I'm predicting another album coming out of this.
Well, what's your next step? Pseudonyms is at Highland Coffees. So what's the next step for James Dean Clater, the musician?
I've got a new album coming out on July 4th, and it's called Planets. And I've got half of the planets done now. I got half more to go.
Half of the planets.
That's right. Each song is titled after a planet.
Really? So
yes.
Do you have the moon?
I do not have the moon, but I do have Mercury, and I do have Saturn, I have Mars, and I have Uranus.
How about Pluto?
Not yet.
Not yet. Not yet. You could have some fun with Pluto, I'm sure. But you're a talented guy from a talented family, and I saw the other day that Leonard Smith was named as one of the new inductees in the College Football Hall of Fame, the former defensive back from McNeese, and I know he played high school ball at Lee High with Dan Clater, who was the leading tackler on that team, and now he's trying to tackle lawmakers, and apparently yesterday he wasn't very successful at it as he got shot down as money was moved from the developmentally disabled statewide to run a private racetrack in Jefferson Parish. We'll see where this goes. We'll talk more tomorrow. Until then, for Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.